3,600 people stuck on a cruise ship in Japan, a floating quarantine to stop the spread of the coronavirus.
You get this weird sensation that, except for the crew members that are coming down the hall, you're the only people on this huge ship.
I'm Marco Werman. The mind games of quarantine ahead this hour. Plus, that respiratory virus may have claimed another victim. Street protests in Hong Kong.
Thousands of rounds of tear gas. That didn't scare them away. Threats from Chinese leader Xi Jinping? Nope. But the coronavirus.
It's keeping pro-democracy demonstrators off of Hong Kong streets. And the classic cartoon Tom and Jerry turns 80 this week. Count among its fans, Iran's supreme leader. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The coronavirus disease now has a name, COVID-19. That's a mashup of the words coronavirus and disease and the year 2019. Researchers have been calling for an official name to avoid stigmatizing any group or country like China. In Beijing today, President Xi Jinping made some public appearances donning a blue surgical face mask. Let's not shake hands, Xi said, adding that China is in a special period. President Xi described the fight against the coronavirus as a war and told workers at a Beijing hospital, "We will be victorious." Meanwhile, in Hong Kong, fear of the coronavirus is also leading to extreme caution, and that's putting a damper on pro-democracy street protests. But as the World's Patrick Nguyen reports, activists are trying to keep the movement going.
Protesters throwing Molotovs, cops firing tear gas grenades. This has defined Hong Kong for about the last 8 months. It got so bad that the government said, "Hey, we can throw you in jail just for wearing a mask in public."
We believe that the new law will create a deterrent effect against masked violent protesters and rioters.
That's Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam announcing the ban on masks back in October. Now, that law hasn't gone away, but something curious is happening. The streets are much more quiet, and if you do go out, it's now taboo to not wear a mask.
If there's somebody else who are not wearing masks, there will be tension from the rest of the crowd because they will think that, oh, this is very irresponsible for a person not wearing a mask in public.
That's Frank Wong, a law student. He's with the Hong Kong City University Student Union, a group that offers legal support to protesters. And the revolution, he says, is really on pause right now because how do you bring out hundreds of thousands of people standing shoulder to shoulder when everyone is scared of getting sick? Until this point, the protesters have been relentless. Thousands of rounds of tear gas, that didn't scare them away. Threats from Chinese leader Xi Jinping to shatter the bones of dissidents, nope. But the coronavirus has finally done what the Chinese government so far has failed to do. That's one recent public demonstration, a small one, and they're not talking about revolution. It's a group of medical workers chanting, "Close the border to save Hong Kong." That's the border with China. Hong Kong's local government has closed most border crossings with China, but some want a total blockade. Fear is increasing, especially after a family in Hong Kong, 9 people, all got the virus by eating hot pot together. So now, panic buying. That's a video from Twitter. Dozens of people at a market in Hong Kong scrambling to buy toilet paper.
There are rumors that some of the daily necessities might be cut off, that the supply of it might be cut off. For example, the tissue papers and rice, even rice.
Frank Wong says that is what everyone is talking about, even inside the protest movement. But also, honestly, the protesters are tired, he says. The marches and street battles, even before the virus, fatigue was setting in. Because also, the police have been making it harder to protest. More beatings, more pepper spray, more arrests.
So we can see that there's some kind of a horror they are creating. That if you step out in protest, you've got to bear some risk.
So while everyone is cooped up in their apartments, Wong says protesters are debating online whether the risk is worth it. Taking over streets in big numbers, is that getting them closer to their goal, which is free elections of local leaders, keeping their sense of autonomy? Some say maybe being so noisy in public isn't the way to go anymore.
We can already see some instances of underground fighting. For example, there are some officers being targeted when they're off duty, where they will be beaten up.
That's already happened. Plus arson attacks on police stations, destroying public property. Wang says once the virus threat is over, protesters may resort to more covert tactics.
So they are turning the movement into the next stage where the movement won't be broadcasted in the air, but they will have underground planning for these targeted attacks.
For now, even though the streets are quiet, the anger is still there, and not just among the protesters. The latest poll by Gallup, which came out yesterday, shows 70% of Hong Kongers have no confidence in their local government. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
They're also dealing with the coronavirus in Japan. Some 3,600 passengers and crew remain trapped on board the Diamond Princess, docked in Yokohama. At least 136 of the ship's passengers have confirmed cases of coronavirus. Americans Matthew Smith and his wife Catherine are among those on board the quarantine cruise ship. Smith told me the experience has been surreal. From his cabin, he has no sight lines of the emergency vehicles or people in hazmat suits patrolling the port.
Our view is of the Yokohama Harbor, and then off the right side of our balcony, there's a pretty suspension bridge that goes across part of the harbor. Behind that is Mount Fuji. So the view has not gotten old yet, but the only people we see are the crew members who deliver the food and bring fresh towels and such. And we get very little sense of any activity that's going on except occasional boats that will swing nearby and people hold up signs or wave. On the other side of the ships, that's on the pier side, they are kind of witnessing the whole transactional things that are going on, all the diagnosed people being taken off in ambulances.
That's fascinating. Kind of like your state of mind regarding this coronavirus depends on what side of the ship you're on or what kind of room you have. So if you were on the other side of the ship and seeing those actual ambulances on the pier and taking passengers away to hospitals, I imagine that might change how you view the whole situation.
Yeah, you have 3,600 people who are having vastly different experiences of quarantine. You know, the only onerous thing, I guess, that we're sharing is that you get this weird sensation that except for the crew members that are coming down the hall and except for the voices of the people you hear on other balconies, because we don't lean out and try and make contact with other people. We're trying to maintain the isolation for the good of the quarantine. You almost get this sense of you're the only people on this huge ship. You know there are other people there, but you have no direct experience of them. So it's really surreal.
What about just your own concerns on the boat? How safe you feel? We've been hearing about possibilities of the virus might spread through the air duct system. I mean, do you have concerns about the quality of the air on the ship?
The captain reported to us today, every cabin is fed with fresh air and not with recirculated air. We have always been confident that the quarantine conditions they're maintaining here are sufficient to prevent infection following the quarantine period. And in fact, it'll be interesting to see whether there are any significant additional cases discovered in the next week, because essentially everyone that's been identified to date can easily be correlated with people who contracted the virus before the quarantine and their symptoms didn't manifest until after the quarantine. 5 days from now, when we're approaching the 2 weeks, if large numbers still show up, well, then you're going to get an issue of, you know, how effective was the quarantine. And I am confident that that's not going to happen. But at the same time, I'm like, you know, all of this is beyond our control. So whatever happens, we'll just deal with it.
What about food? How are you getting fed? And do you trust where your food is coming from?
The crew members bring the food 3 times a day. We get a breakfast, a lunch, and a dinner. All the crew members that are moving about outside the door are masked and gloved and wearing protective clothing. And we're confident that that's not any method by which the virus is going to be spread.
So how do you get your news about updates on the health situation? Are there announcements through the ship's PA? Are you getting any localized news about the virus?
At least two, three times a day, the captain will come on and provide us with the important updates, like he did the other night, that there are 65 new cases. Mm. Another announcement he made today was about that very air system. He wanted to assure all the passengers that all of the cabins are ventilated with fresh air. There is no recirculated air. The passengers who go out on deck, I think, are you know, talking with each other, although they're supposed to stand 6 feet apart when they do so. Mm. And then there seems to be kind of a little gossip network that goes inside the balconies. So they stand out there and chat. And we hear people outside beyond our balcony. I can hear people chatting.
It sounds like you two are just keeping your eyes on the prize. If you stay in your room, contact is avoided, you should be okay. Is that how you're approaching this?
Yeah, absolutely. And when there was talk about, well, you know, why can't the American government come over and get us and take us out and let us serve quarantine in the U.S.? We're like, you know, like, knock it off. Okay, stay in your cabin, follow the rules of the quarantine, and the Japanese government officials are going to let you go. And that's what we're counting on. And so that's what we're trying to do. Just stay the course.
Matt Smith, all our best wishes to you and to Catherine and the rest of the passengers and the crew of the Diamond Princess. Keep the positive attitude. It sounds like it's helping you.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Recognize that? It is the theme from the Tom and Jerry cartoon. It debuted 80 years ago this week and grew into an international sensation. The world's Bianca Hillier looks back at the show's history.
In the 1930s, American media company MGM was a bit desperate. They needed an answer to Walt Disney's Mickey Mouse cartoon. And they found it in the tried-and-true plot of Cat versus Mouse. Creators Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera released the debut short in 1940. Originally, the dynamic cat and mouse duo were named Jasper and Jinx, but soon changed to Tom and Jerry. Tom's the cat who chases adorable Jerry with fantasies of eating him. The scenes most always end with Mouse Jerry outsmarting the cat and inflicting heavy physical damage. Co-creator Joe Barbera said the now iconic lack of dialogue was a sign of the times. Silent movies were big.
There was no discussion about them not speaking. I mean, first of all, I'm a big fan of Chaplin, and everything I saw of him, most anything, was no voice. I found out that with a cat and mouse, you really didn't have to speak.
He was right. Tom and Jerry became one of the world's best-known double acts. But despite the commercial success, MGM faced budget cuts. Creators Hanna and Barbera were sent packing, while MGM outsourced the cartoon in 1961 to a studio in Prague and brought in American animator Gene Deitch to lead production. Deitch told Czech Radio the transition wasn't easy.
Because of the Iron Curtain, the animators in this studio here in Prague had never, ever even seen a Tom and Jerry cartoon. It was way out of their culture.
Deitch also said the names of Czech crew members were Americanized on the show credits to stop Western viewers associating the show with communism. In the 1970s, the cartoon came under a new spotlight for its depictions of race. Early episodes include a character named Mammy Two Shoes, a black housemaid with an exaggerated Southern accent.
And when I say I'm desperate, I mean I.
In 2014, Amazon Prime added a racial prejudice warning to the series. In 2016, the head of Egypt's State Information Service, Ambassador Salah Abdel Sadek, attributed the rise of violence and extremism across the Middle East to the cartoon Cat and Mouse.
Tom and Jerry portrays the violence in a funny manner and sends the message that, yes, I can hit him and I can blow him up with explosives. It becomes set in the viewer's mind that this is natural.
And the Iranian supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has previously compared relations with the U.S. to Tom and Jerry.
Like that famous cat in the Tom and Jerry stories, the United States failed each time.
But in living rooms from Japan to Pakistan to the U.S., the series remains extremely popular. 80 years later, viewers still want more. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Amazing. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The U.S. thought it got away relatively unscathed by Iranian missiles last month, but the number of U.S. service personnel injured by airstrikes in Iraq has gone up again. The Defense Department says that 109 troops have now been treated for mild traumatic brain injuries, or TBIs. That is 50% more than the number previously reported. The Department of Defense takes TBIs seriously. This is Pentagon spokesman Jonathan Hoffman.
We have seen a persistent and dedicated effort by our medical professionals on the ground in Iraq, Kuwait, and Germany to diagnose and treat any and all members who needed assistance. We wish all these members well, and we are dedicated to ensuring that they have the support and treatment they need for a full recovery.
But President Trump has downplayed the recent brain injuries.
I heard that they had headaches and a couple of other things, but I would say, and I can report, it is not very serious.
Kate Kemplin, what is your reaction to that?
So aside from those comments being ill-informed, inappropriate, and insensitive, the Trump administration slashed research funding for some federal agencies by over 170% recently. And studying and treating blast-related TBI in the military requires money. Studying brains of service members with a traumatic brain injury who have committed suicide takes money. And those words hurt.
You have your own connection to traumatic brain injuries. You have a PhD in resilience and suicide among special forces and have spent your career in brain and trauma care as a nurse and now as a researcher. When and why did you choose to specialize in brain injuries?
So I worked as a trauma nurse specialist for the U.S. Army as a civilian in the early 2000s. And I noticed that soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan had really obvious post-concussive symptoms. And most of them, or actually all of them, reported being exposed to a blast, often repetitively on their deployment. And they were having significant personality changes, headaches, marital issues, you know, decision-making issues, a lot of issues with executive function. And so when I started my master's degree, I decided to study traumatic brain injury in combat. And then with life imitating art, my husband, Michael, who was deployed to Iraq, had an IED, actually an EFP, explode under the seat of his vehicle. And so when he returned home, I started to see the same symptoms of traumatic brain injury in him that I'd seen in my patients and in the research that I was doing in graduate school. And so in continuing my education, entering academia, becoming a professor and a nurse scientist, I worked with special operations and began to study their suicides because those tripled in the last couple years. And the intersection between traumatic brain injury and suicide is very well established. And right as I was publishing my initial findings, Michael committed suicide in June of 2019.
I'm very sorry to hear that story. And you connect his taking his life with his TBI.
I think it's impossible not to. As a scientist, I would say no. You know, that's anecdotal and without any causal data or longitudinal study, you know, that's the scientist in me saying I can't make that connection. But as a clinician and as a spouse and as somebody who's worked in this field for over a decade, I think that the connection is concrete because he came back after his blast injury and he was really never the same. And the CDC actually just put out that one of the biggest risk factors for a traumatic brain injury is suicide. And sometimes it can lie dormant and take a decade or longer, but TBI and suicide are very, very connected.
I mean, you're also steeped in the science of TBIs, Kate. What exactly is a traumatic brain injury? What happens to the brain? What causes it?
So it's very different in military populations because in sports or in motor vehicle accidents, the force against the head is solitary. In the military, blast injuries are created by an air pressure wave that is really, really significant. And because the brain is sitting inside your skull and blast pressure waves travel through it, it actually shears connections within the brain at very microscopic levels. And this has been noted in brain tissue postmortem by Dr. Dan Pearl at the Uniformed Services University in Bethesda. So he has a brain repository. He has the brains of soldiers from multiple conflicts. He also has Michael's brain. I sent it there after Michael died. Mm. And they have found astroglial scarring patterns in soldiers who have had blast exposure. And then those soldiers or service members committed suicide after.
Wouldn't those scarring patterns on the brain show up on an MRI?
Not necessarily. There are some clinical guidelines that recommend CAT scans, not necessarily MRIs, but CAT scans to look for really specific physical injuries after traumatic brain injury. But with quote unquote mild traumatic brain injury, it's unlikely or very rare to see something really glaring from a blast injury.
Did Michael acknowledge that he likely had a physical manifestation that was TBI? I mean, what about most soldiers? Are they willing to acknowledge it?
I think it's tough for a lot of soldiers. I think it's really difficult to acknowledge that something wrong might be happening or that an injury that you walked away from is affecting you to the degree that these injuries can. In Michael's instance, he had a wife who had studied this extensively, and so he knew and he acknowledged that his brain was injured. However, he worked in classified environments and he had a security clearance, and he would not acknowledge it officially because he could lose his career. And even though the Department of Defense assures service members that, you know, they won't lose any security clearances for seeking mental health treatment, I know from my colleagues in the military and my own experience that it's a very real fear. So to my knowledge, I don't think Michael really ever got comprehensive treatment for it. And that was a main reason why we divorced in 2013.
Kate, I know you and Michael Frody had children. May I ask how they're doing?
They're pretty tough girls. They're doing really well. And, you know, we've been very, very open and honest about Mike's injuries and how they've processed it and processed his death. We haven't hidden anything from them or tried to sugarcoat anything, you know, because this is not an issue that you can sweep under the carpet or pretend that there weren't issues or injuries that preceded it. So we handle it with a lot of humor and honesty and tears at times. And, you know, sometimes they're angry and sometimes they don't understand. And that's normal. And everything that they're feeling is normal. And there's no right way to feel or right way to process it. It's just something you have to walk through. And there's really no getting over it. It's always going to be there. It's just going to change and morph over time.
Kate Kemplin is a professor and neuroscientist at the University of Windsor, Ontario. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Professor Kemplin's late husband, Sergeant Michael Frody, will be laid to rest in Arlington National Cemetery next month. You're with the world. Learning a second language is tough, so how come some people can pick up 7, 8, 9 languages no problem? We look inside the brains of polyglots.
We know which parts of your brain are doing work during these different tasks that we're going to give you. And today we're doing language tasks.
The science behind the gift of multilingual gab, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. President Rodrigo Duterte of the Philippines basically flipped the bird at the United States today. Manila gave notice that it's terminating the Visiting Forces Agreement, which allows for large-scale joint military exercises between the two countries. It also provides a security blanket for the United States, effectively keeping the Philippines out of China's orbit. But geopolitics may not be the main reason for Duterte to ditch the agreement. It seems to be personal, a reaction to U.S. criticism of his controversial anti-drug policy. Sofia Tomacruz reports for Rappler, a news website in the Philippines. She joins us from Manila. What is the government saying the reason is for ending the Visiting Forces Agreement with the United States, Sofia?
So if you go by President Rodrigo Duterte's words, He said that he wanted to scrap the visiting forces agreement with the United States over the cancellation of a senator, Senator Ronald De La Rosa's U.S. visa. And now, one thing to note about De La Rosa is widely known as the architect of his controversial anti-illegal drug campaign, his drug war. That was really one big reason why Duterte wanted to end the VFA. Another being sanctions that the U.S. lawmakers have pushed for against Philippine officials involved in the drug war, specifically extrajudicial killings, and also those who were involved in the detention of opposition Senator Ana de Lima.
And did Duterte actually come out and kind of state all these reasons for why he wanted to cancel the agreement?
Yeah, he said this on the record in public speeches before different crowds. I mean, it's not a new threat that he's made, but he made that threat early in 2016 when the U.S. didn't renew an aid package for the Philippines. But I think one thing that's different, that makes this latest threat different, is that the attack was more personal because his former police chief was targeted. It's always a touchy issue for him when you talk about the drug war and everything.
So you mentioned the senator who's in detention, Leyly de Lima. Mm-hmm. Tell us about her.
She is a vocal critic of the president and his drug war. When she was the Secretary of Justice before she became a senator, she had launched investigations against Duterte when he was the mayor of Davao City because of supposed death squads that he had basically power over. Of course, she continued speaking out against the drug war when she was already in the Senate, and President Rodrigo Duterte had already won the presidency. And so that earned her the ire of the president. The government came up with trumped-up charges against her and arrested her. And so she's been in jail now for about 3 years.
Has the United States, has Washington made any kind of attempts to intervene on her behalf or say anything about her case?
Well, we can go by what U.S. lawmakers have done. I think the most concrete would be how the U.S. Senate adopted a resolution invoking the Global Magnitsky Act, which is, as we know, is the U.S.'s law that imposes travel restrictions and financial restrictions against people who are guilty of grave human rights abuses. So at least in the context of the Philippines, in the context of De Lima's case, they invoked that for any Philippine official who was involved in what they called was her unlawful detention.
I want to ask you one more thing before we let you go, Sophia. This week, the Philippine government asked the country's Supreme Court to shut down the country's largest television network for alleged constitutional violations. What is that all about?
Mm-hmm. So the Office of the Solicitor General asked the Supreme Court to void the franchise of the largest broadcast network here in the Philippines, which is ABS-CBN. And it's largely seen, of course, as an attack on press freedom. What happened is the Solicitor General basically questioned ABS-CBN's franchise, accusing it of foreign ownership, saying that it wasn't using its franchise according to the terms that it was granted to them.
Is the network generally critical of Duterte?
It's been perceived to be critical of Duterte and his anti-illegal drug campaign. And so, yeah, it is perceived to be critical.
That's Sophia Toma Cruz in Manila, where she reports for the online news site Rappler. Sophia, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
For most of us, learning a second or third language takes a ton of time and a ton of effort. I speak French, but not because of French classes. I only became fluent after being immersed in France and French-speaking Africa for years. Patrick Cox is here. He's the co-host of the podcast Subtitle. Same for you, Patrick.
Yeah, I kind of mastered Danish after I lived there, but I struggle with most other languages that I've attempted. I'm certainly no polyglot, that's for sure. But I'm here to tell you about polyglots and an ongoing study of the polyglot brain.
So polyglots, those are people who speak multiple languages, like three or four or five languages.
Yeah, and here's how little we know about them. Until quite recently, it was believed that polyglots tended to be, take your pick, male or gay or left-handed, none of which is true. We may know more soon, though, and here's why.
This is our magnet. This is our scanner. So we can actually go inside.
We're at a windowless lab at MIT. Lab manager Hope Keane is prepping a woman who's about to slide into a brain scanner, an fMRI machine, for a series of tests.
We have like a time course of where blood is flowing in your brain, and we know which parts of your brain are doing work during these different tasks that we're going to give you. And today we're doing language tasks, since you're a polyglot and know so many languages.
As far as the researchers are aware, this is the first modern-day study of the polyglot brain. Susanna Zurayski is the study's 23rd participant.
I speak Russian, English, French, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, Bosnian, Serbo-Croatian, and also Ladino, which is the Spanish spoken by the Jews who were expelled from Spain in the 15th century.
Just the 9 languages, plus a bit of Arabic, Hebrew, Hungarian, and Greek. And she doesn't study these languages in much of a formal way, in a classroom, repeating words, doing homework, which sets her apart from other polyglots.
You give them a grammar book and they just absorb it, you know.
Dudes, more men.
Yes, more men, yeah, that really like the grammar books. I would be bored out of my mind if I had something like that.
This is part of the problem in studying polyglots. Is the brain functioning the same way for grammar book learners as it is for someone like Susanna, who learns through conversation and singing songs? Scientists have been trying to figure that out for nearly a century.
I went to look at the brain of Emil Krebs, who was a German diplomat who died in 1930.
This is Michael Erard, who's written a book about polyglots.
And his brain, after he died, became part of a expert genius brain collection in Dusseldorf.
Krebs's brain was sliced into pieces and preserved, for good reason. In his lifetime, he acquired a proficiency in something like
68 different languages.
Recently, German neuroscientists took another look at Krebs's brain and found some anomalies, denser cell structures in certain unexpected regions. But the researchers couldn't be certain about the timeline.
Was there something about Krebs's brain that preceded his exposure to any of those languages that would have allowed him to build those structures faster, more durably than other people's brains would have been?
In other words, was Emil Krebs born with a predisposition for multilingualism, or did that develop over time? Erard says the scientists couldn't tell.
You can't surmise that from the slices of brain that I was looking at.
Which is why the MIT study of living polyglot brains offers more promise. Polyglot Susanna Zurayski is now inside the fMRI machine. She has earbuds on and she's being bombarded with voices. Sometimes she hears a familiar language.
On a certain day, an angel of God came to a young virgin named Mary.
Sometimes it's something less familiar. And sometimes it's gibberish. All the while, technicians are monitoring blood flow, which tells them which regions of the brain are most active at any given moment. Results so far have been a bit counterintuitive, says lab director Ev Fedorenko. The control group here are monolinguals, people who speak only one language. For them, the regions of the brain that are associated with language appear quite large on activation maps.
But for the polyglot, it looked like it was way, way kind of on the end of a continuum where these regions were small.
In other words, the polyglots were less, not more, engaged.
That seemed to be a real finding, which then we started interpreting because it seemed like a real thing. And the most kind of obvious, plausible interpretation is in terms of efficiency.
But this isn't a longitudinal study, so researchers can't fully answer the question of whether polyglots were born with this efficiency or developed it over time. It's not a genetic study either, so we don't know if any of those traits are hereditary. However, lab director Ev Fedorenko suspects that polyglots are far from brilliant superhumans, just people who blend talent with extreme dedication.
Most brains can find ways to get good at things. Hard work will often get you a long way. Like, I think brilliance is often overrated.
Which comes as a relief to the rest of us. It's nice to know that learning languages doesn't necessarily require you to possess a superpower. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
The Department of Justice is turning up the heat on local and state governments that offer sanctuary to undocumented immigrants. Attorney General William Barr has announced new lawsuits against California, New Jersey, and King County in Washington State. All three places have sought to offer some protection from federal immigration authorities and possible deportation. Dow Constantine is the executive for King County. What did King County actually do that upset the Trump administration?
Well, thanks for having me. We run an international airport known as Boeing Field, and we came to find out that tens of thousands of immigrants into this country were being rounded up and deported through that airport on charter flights. by the federal government. I issued an executive order stating that we would do anything within our power to stop that practice. It's inconsistent with county law and with the values of our region, and we will not be a party to this administration's political agenda. It's inhumanity to refugees and immigrants. We've been involved in an informal process with the FAA to sort through the legal issues and determine the authorities of the county and the federal government over King County International Airport Boeing Field. Suddenly, the Trump administration decided to grab some headlines by circumventing that orderly process and filing a lawsuit.
Well, as you probably heard, the federal government says that King County is interfering with its ability to enforce immigration law. Well, how do you respond to that?
We in King County, as a matter of county policy, made a choice not to facilitate this administration's campaign against refugees and immigrants. We will follow the law, and we will invest our time and effort in helping people have their rights vindicated in court.
Interestingly, ICE has sent the planes from your airport, Boeing Field, to Yakima's airport instead. It's about 150 miles away. So while you and King County might be complicating things, you're not really stopping the deportations.
Well, clearly that's going to be a continuing problem. We as a local government need to act consistent with our regional values. Yakima is home to many, many immigrants from Mexico and Latin America who are feeling very threatened right now. And that community is having to do some soul searching about the role that they're playing in this Trump policy.
How much authority does King County have over its cooperation with ICE?
We have a good deal of authority. Our law is very clear that we will not cooperate with federal authorities on deportation unless we are presented with a valid court order. When our judges say that someone is free to leave the jail because they have served their time, they're free to leave, and we will not respond to the order of a federal bureaucrat, but we will comply with the order of a judge. So if they bring us a warrant, we will treat it as any other warrant.
Are you confident that you'll win this case?
We're very confident we'll win this case. The executive order I issued makes it clear that we will operate within the bounds of the law, but we will not take actions that will in any way harm immigrants, refugees, or facilitate this cruel policy by the Trump administration. What we need is for Trump and Barr to quit focusing on punishing local jurisdiction and trying to intimidate us and others, and instead to turn their attention to comprehensive immigration reform in Congress.
Dow Constantine, the executive for King County, Washington State. Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much.
It's an odd and sad coincidence that today, on the 30th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release from prison, one of the voices that gave hope to black South Africans during apartheid leaves us. Joseph Shabalala was born in 1941 in the town of Ladysmith, South Africa. Founder of the legendary group you're hearing, a cappella singers Ladysmith Black Mambazo. We learned that Shabalala died today. When he created Ladysmith Black Mambazo in 1960, the music was not overtly anti-apartheid. The band was more messengers of black South African culture. Shabalala told me in 2004 that this hymn-like music confused some black South African activists.
In fact, I was doubting of them that they might don't understand what are we talking about.
Eventually, they did get it. By promoting culture, Shabalala and Ladysmith quietly infiltrated black activism in South Africa. They recorded with and were recognized by none other than Paul Simon, which only led to Grammys for the band in their own right. Shabalala had told me that his whole life he just wanted a home for his Zulu culture. After apartheid, he said he saw it happening whenever he saw the reaction of South African kids hearing the music of Ladysmith Black Mambazo for the first time.
Whoa, where is this music? There's nothing like this at school. Where are these people? He's very good, and the old people correct that. No, this man has a talent. He's talking about something here. He has a talent. He born with it. These are the people we need here.
Joseph Shabalala was 78. For the political geeks among us, the long wait is finally over. New Hampshire voters are heading to the polls.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Polls are open.
That was just past midnight in the tiny town of Hart's location, population 41. For days, Democratic presidential candidates have been frantically crisscrossing the state, appealing for last-minute votes.
This is our moment in history.
And here we are at decision time, and it is so critically important that we get this right.
And not only is the whole country looking at New Hampshire, but the world is looking at New Hampshire. What is New Hampshire going to do?
Front runners there, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, and Bernie Sanders. As the Dems are delivering their message in the Granite State, Republicans are going nationwide with their appeals to win over new voters to join the grand old party, namely Latinos. The World's Daisy Contreras joins me now. She's the editor of our Every 30 Seconds project, which tracks a generation of young Latinos. Every 30 seconds in America, another Latino becomes eligible to vote. So, Daisy, there seems to be a general assumption that Latinos vote Democratic. Is that true?
The short answer is yes, but it's also important to understand that just looking at the majority does not give us the entire picture. In the midterm elections in 2018, yes, the majority of Latino voters went for a Democratic candidate in these congressional races at about 70%, while about 30% backed the Republican candidate. And over the years, the number of Latinos who have voted for the Republican Party has stayed pretty consistent.
And those numbers have stayed consistent even when we're hearing strong anti-immigrant rhetoric from the president and those circles?
Yeah, I mean, and that's another thing about the myth of the Latino electorate, that immigration is a deal breaker for all. I mean, it's not completely true, especially for many Republicans. While Latinos do have ties to Latin American countries like Venezuela, Mexico, El Salvador, they have unique circumstances that brought them here to the United States. Things like how much money a family has, for example, or how many generations a family has been in the U.S. could help shape those perspectives. So, for example, we've heard a lot from Trump recently about Venezuela. Here's Trump at the State of the Union address last week.
The United States is leading a 59-nation diplomatic coalition against the socialist dictator of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro.
Trump is using events in those countries to appeal to conservative Latinos here in the United States. And so Florida, for example, has a large Venezuelan population, and Trump sees that. And he also knows that this is the key state for him to win re-election. So in short, immigration could be part of the issues that Republican Latinos are caring about, but it isn't necessarily a priority. For them, it's more about the economy, jobs, healthcare, and maybe even border security. And if you've been voting for a Republican candidate, chances are that you've been loyal to the party for many generations.
So all those things, the economy, jobs, healthcare, is the president messaging those things to Latinos?
Well, going back to the State of the Union address again, Trump talked about the economy and how it's going for Latinos.
The unemployment rate for African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Asian Americans has reached the lowest levels in history.
So I spoke to Jesus Solorio. He's with the Republican National Hispanic Assembly of Illinois. It's a political organization. Solorio says Trump understands there needs to be more outreach and support, not just for the African-American community, but for women and Latinos.
It's clear that a lot of the policies that he's been advocating for, you know, specifically like school choice and lowering taxes and increasing jobs, has really resonated with the Hispanic community. And I think that we're going to see a bump in those numbers come November.
Daisy, what about young Latino voters specifically, the group that we're focusing on with Every 30 Seconds?
Solorio and other organizations that work with the Republican Party say they are going out into communities. They are going to college campuses and talking to Latino high school students to get them more involved with the party, very similar to what the Democratic Party is also doing. Solorio says outreach is even happening in blue states like Illinois, where the Democratic stronghold is there.
You do find many pockets of Hispanic population throughout the state. And we've been able to go to various community events, and we've been able to, again, just interact with the community and say, you know, this is who we are, this is what the Republican Party stands for, and this is what we're fighting for.
So both parties are definitely out there trying to appeal to this young demographic. And as we've been hearing, their vote is up for grabs.
Daisy Contreras, the editor of the World's Every 30 Seconds Project. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Here's some advice for any candidate hoping for support from new Latino voters hitting the age of 18. Book this guy for your next rally. This is Cuco. His shows typically sell out. When we spoke recently, he just played a gig in Texas.
My last concert was in El Paso, and that was like 2,000 people. It was just cool, like just seeing all these people come out, just showing mad support, mad love, you know?
Of course it was cool. 5-6 years ago, living the dream wasn't even a dream for Cuco. He was born Omar Banos in Southern California. Parents are from Mexico. He started making beats as a teenager.
I like playing music, and I thought like it'd be cool to like make my own tunes.
It was pretty rudimentary stuff at first, the equipment, the studio.
In my room, like it was just like a computer and like a cheap little amplifier. I didn't even have monitors or nothing.
But suddenly, everyone was dancing to those tunes.
Don't play with me, you broke my heart, but I'm also so obsessed with you. I don't know if I love you. I don't know if I hate you. Baby, it's time to get out my way, get out my life. I'm so sick of you just playing.
Good old teenage angst. Even if Cuco's songs are not political, his fans know what's going on.
Like, we have events that are specifically catered to, you know, undocumented folks and how they could get help, you know?
Have the politics of this country changed you as an artist in the last 3 years?
Yeah, I mean, definitely makes me want to be more active, be more aware and bring awareness of certain, you know, issues that are happening in the States, because it's so weird, like it seems like kind of unreal.
Cuco takes us out on the down tempo today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you again tomorrow.
As it hits the floor, it's time to say goodbye.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.